This episode of Danger Talk is sponsored by DraftKings, America's top-rated daily fantasy app.
Welcome back to Danger Talk. I am Jeff Dye. This is episode 10. We got the man, the myth, the legend, Russell Wilson. What a week, bud. Man, the sky seemed like it was falling on us in Seattle. We had the loss. And then you come right back, you go to Arizona and crush it. How you feeling?
Man, I'm feeling way better than the weeks before. Speaking about the sky falling, obviously living in Seattle here, it's always a little cloudy in this time of year. But, if you want to be on the top of the mountain, I think that you have to be willing to fall and slip a little bit. And you have to keep climbing. And I think that in any great athlete, you know, any great comedian, any great business person, no matter what, if you want to be great, there's going to be tough moments, because to get to greatness, there's always challenges and roadblocks in your way. And I think that, you know, I've gone through an amazing season so far. It's been really cool. We've thrown a bunch of touchdowns, and now I think we had 30 plus touchdown passes and 31 or something like that, you know, total or whatever. But there's been a couple blunders along the way, I guess. But, you know, it's one of those things that you just keep swinging, like I said earlier in the week. And I think that my mentality, you know, is something that has helped separate me a little bit, Jeff, just in terms of I don't like losing. I hate losing.
Well, you don't do it that often, which is great.
But it's one of those things that I'm obsessed with winning, the process of it. And so when you put your whole life and lifestyle and thought process into everything being, you know, perfect in how you want it to be in terms of the game and the situations and situational football and all that stuff. And sometimes, you know, the ball bounces the other way. And I think that's just been a thing. And, you know, obviously, you know, I just didn't have Twitter or social media on my phone for, you know, a while, and just staying away from any negative talk, because otherwise you can fall in love with it. And you can also kill yourself because of it, you know, emotionally, essentially, and it can affect you. And you've seen it with other athletes, you've seen it with other people. But I think for me, you can't let that stuff get to you, because, you know, when you're striving for something great, you don't have time for anything else to get in the way. And so I think that's been a big part of leadership and big part of perspective for me. And, you know, it's been a cool year, I think, in terms of football, but this year's had challenges of itself. You know, it's had,
sure,
you know, think about 2020 as a whole, it's been a challenging year. And if I'm selfish enough to be so consumed with my own worries and concerns and, oh, that play or this play, then that's just wrong of me. Because to me, you know, I got to have a heart of gratitude, an attitude of gratitude. You got to be able to see through the mess, see through the chaos, and what is going well? I got this team. I got these guys. I got these great offense. There's so much good going on. So don't be distracted by the mess. And sometimes, sometimes in the midst of everything, in the midst of the storm, you have to see past the storm. You have to see that there's clearer skies on the other end of it all. And that's what kind of this week's kind of been for me. And to obviously come out on Thursday night and get a huge win, you know, at home against the Arizona Cardinals team, that was so great. But that was big. That was a big win for us.
Yeah, I said you went to Arizona, but this was actually in the newly named Seahawks Stadium. I don't even know what it's called
Lumen,
now. But
Lumen Field.
But the thing that made this week so unique was to come off of a loss. Usually you get 6 days to regroup, plan a football game, be the quarterback, be the leader. This was such a short span to come off of a loss and get yourself gathered, get the team ready, prepare, and try to beat a team that's a divisional game coming off of the other one, which was divisional. Did you beat yourself up after the Rams game?
Well, I already felt beat up. You know, anytime you play an NFC West team, you know you're going to get banged up a little bit. It's the hardest division of football, hands down. And then to go from, you know, from that game Sunday, having to hop on a plane down to LA, come back, not win the game going like crap, and then having to come back home and have to play Thursday night. People understand how much, like, I mean, we didn't get home till 11:30 that Sunday night. Next thing you know, we got a meeting at 7 a.m., getting ready. It's 8 a.m., getting ready for the next day. having to install all these plays. I mean, we got over 350, 400 plays in the playbook, maybe more sometimes. And it's like, I have to know everything. I have to know all the information, all that stuff. And so to get prepared for all the film you got to watch to prepare for the next team that you have to play, which is the Arizona Cardinals, and still having to deal with the emotional aspect of just losing a game, which it takes usually for me, for most people, it can take a week. You know, for me, it takes a good 24 hours, you know, but when you're playing on a short week, it feels like a lot longer because, you know, normally on Monday, we just have a short meeting, watch the film, all that stuff. And then Tuesday you have off and I'm busy watching film and doing things and going to Children's Hospital, all that stuff. So it kind of clears my mind. The next thing you know, Wednesday, okay, we're practicing again. And then all with Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But well, Thursday night game, it's Monday. You're already game planning third down, first and second down, red zone on Monday. Next thing you know, on Tuesday, you're playing in red zone. And on Wednesday, you're putting everything together and making sure you like all the plays that you like. And what you don't like, you throw out into the trash can. And then, you know, next thing you know, you're staying in the hotel Wednesday night. The game's Thursday. Boom. Here we go. And so for all the things that, you know, you have to deal with and go through, especially come off a loss and, you know, people hating on you in a way, it's one of those things that you can't lose the fact that you got another moment coming up. And to be able to transition your mind, but also your body, and knowing that, okay, I have a process. I'm going to keep trusting my process. Let's accelerate my process. I have my whole performance team that helps get me ready. I went swimming right away, you know, Monday morning, first thing. I went swimming, you know, Tuesday, getting my body ready, doing all my body work and treatment. All it's been hours upon hours while watching film. All this stuff's going on while silencing my mind and getting prepared to go win. It's a fascinating thing. And, you know, it's to take that physical beating and then have to take it again. It's like two car crashes in 1 week. Yeah. I mean, it's like two car crashes in 1 week with no helmet on. It's like, that's what it feels like, you know? You know, and so it's like, man, it's like, whew, you know, and then you have the emotional side of it too that you have to deal with and balance and have perspective on. So I think I've, you know, been fortunate to be able to balance it well and just keep coming back, you know, keep swinging. Like I said, you know, it's one of those things that you got to keep coming back and believe in that something great's going to happen. And so, yeah, it's been a key week for us and to be able to overcome that.
I love that. Yeah, we only get to see gridiron rust, man. We don't get to see you the next day. I imagine your body is just beaten up. And even if you won and you didn't get sacked or anything, like I imagine just the next day it's exhausting, let alone if you did get roughed up a little bit. I can't imagine the next day process physically and mentally. Let's talk about the game a little bit. I mean, you guys came out swinging on the first touchdown. On the opening drive, right? You had a scramble drill to DK Metcalf, big touchdown. What's going through a quarterback's head when you scramble like that? I mean, do you practice scrambles as a team? How does that work?
We practice scrambles. I think it's something naturally that I do, but it's like, it's absolute chaos and people flying around. You don't know where people are. If you kind of look at the footage, I'm like left, right, like, where are they? Boom, boom, boom. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, and I'm feeling like, where's everybody at? And, it kind of feels like a dream, but yet a nightmare at the same time. You know, it's like, am I in a dream? Am I in a nightmare? Like, where am I at? And where are they at? So anyways, you come out of the pocket. Next thing you know, I'm feeling the line of scrimmage. I'm feeling it. Did I pass the line of scrimmage? I got to sense my kind of sixth senses kind of show up. And it's just kind of one of those things. I kind of feel like Spider-Man or something like that. He's like, well, where's everybody at? Where's everything at? And you kind of just get out there in the pocket and you're feeling where everything is, and next thing I know, whew, here comes that flash of lightning, DK Metcalf going down from the left to right, and he just kind of passes in my eyes. I'm, you know, I know the guy defender's coming. I can feel him breathing down my neck, and it's like, okay, what am I doing? And flick it out to him, and he catches a sweet touchdown. So, you know, it's a chaotic feeling, but it's chaos in the midst of, you know, this poise and calmness and understanding and decisiveness that you got to have. And I think that's what makes it so dynamic. That's what makes it so unique. And to be honest with you, that's what makes it, I think, the hardest position in the world.
I'm telling you guys make it super, super fun to watch, man. When you're scrambling and when DK is, anything DK does, he's a big giant. It's just so fun to watch. The Seahawks are 7-3, back in first place in the NFC West. That makes me so happy to say. So what's your outlook for the rest of the regular season? I mean, you've talked about it almost every week because I pest you with the same type of questions like this, but What's your outlook? What do we got going? What's in Russ's brain? What's your look for the regular season, for the rest of the regular season?
I think we're hitting this Thursday night game right at the right time. I think for all Seahawks fans out there and people just generally who are fans, but I think the reality is we're hitting this perfect patch right now. We've always kind of been one of those teams that just continually gradually grows, and I think we want to continue that. And so for us, we go to the Philly coming up here in a Monday night football. It's going to be a great matchup. They can really do some special things on defense. It's one of those teams. They've had a lot of great players, and they have a lot of great players and can do some cool things. And always playing Philly's always tough. And so us getting ready, but we have this Thursday, we have this, Friday, Saturday, Sunday here where we kind of get our bodies back, to feel great again. It's kind of this short mini bye, it's like a little mini vacation. It's like you flying down to Cabo from LA, Jeff Dye, it's a little quick, easy flight, and just you get to refresh. But it's one of those things that we're excited about it. I think that we're excited about, what we have, in terms of our team. We got some guys coming back. We got Chris Carson coming back soon. So there's a lot of good things ahead of us. But we got to keep going, and we can't relax, and we gotta get prepared. So I'm excited about it. And so I'm excited about where we're heading and what we're doing, but I'm also excited about our new guest that we have coming on here, Jeff Dye, because our guest is going to be amazing.
Too.
Our guest today has a laundry list of titles. He's an entrepreneur, television personality, NBA owner, investor, and so much more. You may know him from ABC's Shark Tank. Please welcome the one and only Mark Cuban. Mark, you there?
I'm absolutely here, Russ, man. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to do this.
Man, I'm excited too. I go back to the Entourage movie set, man. Me and you sitting down where were we? Rancho Palos Verdes? We're sitting out there?
Something like that, yeah. It was a great crib, man. It was fun. It was a fun day.
That crib was amazing. And then they had the big old movie set and everything else. And we're sitting there, kicking back, having a good old time. And that was a good experience. You've been in a lot of movies, huh?
Yeah, I like doing that stuff. Like in business, it's all right brain, where you're trying to be in control all the time. All the acting stuff, you just got to let go, even when I'm playing myself. But, I've managed to really improve my craft. Sharknado 3, playing president, elevated me. I was really disappointed when I didn't win an Emmy for it. But, yeah, I like doing that stuff a lot.
Yeah, so as you know, we got our co-host here, Jeff Dye. And, Jeff, I'm still mad at Mark. Mark, you and I got a little beef. Yeah, a little beef. I'm going to tell you why. Yeah. I came to the Dallas Mavericks game. I sat down front row with you. We had a good time. We were over there talking. You nudged me. We talked about this on Entourage set as well. Listen, you told me you're going to give me a 10-day contract. And sure enough, to this day, I'm sitting here. I got this empty piece of paper right here with nothing to sign here. I'm waiting for my 10-day contract. Free agency's going on right now. I'm a free agent.
That's a cold-ass call-out right there.
Well, one, we gave that contract to Tony Romo. Two, he told me, literally, did you see when we had him on the court? Got him all dressed up. The league wouldn't let us. But you told me that, look, I told you, if you're going down to the G League and get a run in, because you told me how good you were, I'm all for it, right? But you were too big time for it,
You're exactly right. You're exactly right, Mark Cuban. And you got Tony Romo all dressed up. You can't tell me Tony Romo is a better basketball player than me. Tony, I'm calling you out too.
Zero chance.
Hey, Tony Romo was all state in Wisconsin with Caron Butler. Tony Romo could play.
Yeah, he was all state in Wisconsin. That's okay. I come from the place
maybe
where AI came from.
Anna.
Yeah, exactly.
So, no, wait. So let me just tell you how I met Tony Romo real quick. So where I played pickup, we're playing, and this guy is just dealing on me, right? And just like scoring at will. I'm like, what the? And he's like, and I'm like, who is this guy? And he goes, yeah, my name's Tony Romo. I'm like a new quarterback for the Cowboys. And this is before anybody even knew who's just signed as a free agent, an undrafted free agent. And to work out, he'd come and play pickup with us, So there you go. Yeah. And I knew because he had a little bit on something on me.
No, Tony's an absolute baller. He's actually a really good, obviously, commentator throughout the game, too, as well. He's getting the big checks right now.
Yeah, he is. And that's another story I'll tell you someday.
Well, you can tell us here.
Great basketball
you can tell
player,
us here.
And I heard he played quarterback for a little while.
Yeah, he played a little bit of quarterback. But when he was negotiating his contract, it was me, him, and Jerry Jones sitting down talking about it. I'll let him tell you. But it was an interesting conversation. Tony's a good dude, man. I like spending time with him.
Yeah, he's great, man. He's always been special. I want to I want to sit in that conversation where you, Mark Cuban, and Tony Romo and Tony Romo and Jerry Jones are sitting together talking. Are you probably on Jerry Jones's yacht, or what are you guys doing over there?
Yeah, we were on Jerry Jones's yacht. It was like the first or second time he had used it. And he's got this crazy scotch, and I'm not a big scotch drinker at all, but it's like this $9 million bottle of scotch or whatever. And we're all just sipping it. And Jerry's telling stories, and Tony's telling stories, and I'm just like listening. And then we got into business, and Jerry's a smart dude. So it was fun to listen to him.
Yeah. What's it like to have a $9 million bottle of scotch on the yacht? And then what I really want to know is, you know, and Jeff Dye and I both want to know this. What's it like to be a multi-billionaire? I want to be a multi-billionaire like you. What's the feeling of just being a multi-billionaire?
Yeah, I'm a thousandaire. Russ is a millionaire. I'd like to hear what it's like to be a billionaire.
It feels really fucking good. I'm not gonna lie. There's nothing wrong with it. There's no downside, man. And I pinch myself every day. You know, I'm not somebody who thought, okay, I can get there. You know, growing up, if I bust my ass, it just happened.
Yeah.
You know, and I try not to take it for granted, and I try to enjoy it. And, you know, it's crazy. I mean, I never would imagine in my wildest dreams.
Is it one of those things that once you become a billionaire, it's like, you know, you think about, we got a lot of billionaires here in Seattle, for example. We got Jeff Bezos, we got Bill Gates, we got, you know, unfortunately, Paul Allen passed away. We got so many billionaires just here in this area right here alone. Is it one of those things that, like, once you become a billionaire, you're like, you know, you're happy for that guy, or do you want to like make more than that guy? Or is it one of those things like, you know what, I'm not worried about anything?
You know, when it first happened, I was like, okay, let me see how high I can get on the Forbes 400 list. And then I realized, what, that's crazy, right? I mean, that's just, then I just started to have fun with it. Bought the Mavs, right? Just started doing, the one thing it does buy me, I could buy a plane, and it bought me time. You know, you can't, you know, once time is gone, you can't get it back, obviously, but you know, I could do things to my schedule. I can get on my plane and leave and come back when I wanted. And that allowed me to have better control of my time. And that's the biggest difference, you know, because the reality is, if you were miserable when you were poor, then adding money is not, it'll reduce your stress. You don't have to worry about the bills, but you're still, you know, I've talked to lots of rich people that are still miserable. If you were cool, if you were having fun when you were poor, like I was, and loving life, and then you add all this money to it, it just gets a lot more fun. And that's how I get to do the things like the Mavs and the Entourages and all that kind of stuff, because I don't have to stress about, you know, all the things I used to stress about.
Yeah. So what have you been up to in 2020? Jeff, I know you've been up to some stuff. What have you guys been up to in 2020? What you guys been doing?
Me? Nada. You know, watch, you know, NBA season gets canned, then it comes back, and Shark Tank and kids and pandemic, you know, 2020. It's 2020, man. How can you even describe it?
Well, Jeff and I were talking before the show about how, you know, Jeff, you remember that clip where Mark was all just shocked when COVID hit and NBA shut down?
He's mortified. Well, he's like, but I can't watch my Mavs.
Yeah, no, man. I was in shock. I mean, it was just like, so backstory to that, before the game, you know, people were talking, are we going to have to cancel? Are they going to shut down games? And the players were curious. And so I walk into the locker room and I'm like, guys, I don't know. You know, if we walk out there and there's a big crowd, maybe it's better than we think. And Luca says, you know, Mark, I'm here in Europe. They're shutting things down. Are we going to shut the season down? I'm like, Luca, probably 5-10% chance that we postpone or shut the season down. Third quarter of the game against the Nuggets, bam, I get the text, and I was shocked, right? And you can just see it on my face. I was like, what the hell? You know, and like everybody else, it was like, I had no idea what was going to come next.
Well, one of the coolest things
that poker with Mark Cuban.
Oh yeah, I'm awful at poker. I'm like, you know, it's just like, here's my cards. Let me write my cards down, or I'll just put my cards down on my forehead.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really cool, you know, that you were able to do, and you really supported just your staff and everybody that worked, you know, for the Mavs and everything else. I was really inspired by that. You know what, you know, and we kind of laughed and joked, and also being serious about the billionaire thing and being able to make an impact. But, you know, to be honest with you, a lot of owners in sports, they're not really involved with the community as much. They're not really involved in the winning process and the culture of, you know, of sports and of the culture of just the team and everything else. You're so heavily involved, which is really, I've always admired about you from a distance. And even I got to, you know, go to the, you know, to Dallas Mavs and see them play and how involved you are, how passionate you were, and just how excited we were for the game. And I was excited for my 10-day contract and still never got it. But, you know, I'm just saying, you know, you were so heavily invested in, you've been so heavily invested into the community and people.
What's like you guys, like you and Pierre, right? I mean, you know that, you know, we're people, it's not like football or basketball is the most important thing in the world, especially now in a pandemic, but people look up to us. People look up to you and to Luka Doncic and Kristaps Porzingis and the Mavs and the Seahawks become part of their lives. And it's something they look forward to. And when we run into a situation like this, I mean, we're part of the community. And, you know, during regular times, the community lifts us up,
yeah,
right? We're the only sport. You know, when the Seahawks win a Super Bowl, they throw parades, right? You know, the whole city's on fire. The whole region's on fire, man. And you just can't, everybody's excited. And, you know, when the Mavs won, it was the same thing. And on the flip side, when things aren't going well, you know, you hear about it, right? Because people share it with you because you become part of their families. And you know, Dallas has given me so much and given the Mavericks so much. I think it's important to give back, just like you guys do, right? I see all the things that you do for the community. It's important to you, you know, and you go out of your way to help kids and organizations and be a leader in it. And I try to follow that same lead where, you know, we're so blessed that it just, we're able to help people and we're able to, you know, help people deal with their issues where we can. And I think it's important to do so.
I think that's a great point. I think that, you know, for me and C, it's, you know, we were able to make a difference, you know, with, you know, Feeding America and to partnering up with Wheels Up, with Meals Up, and, you know, with our foundation, yep, Why Not You Foundation. And it was so important for us to be able to make a difference in Seattle and just across the country, because the reality is that it's a responsibility. It's a responsibility and an obligation, in my opinion. You know, yep, the Bible talks about much is given, much is required. And to be able to give back,
yep,
to people, I think it's so important just because God's gifted us with the opportunity to. And
100%.
From the outside looking in, it seems like you guys both care too. That's the difference, is that you care, and that's why you do it. I think that's one thing people forget. Some people are blessed and they don't care. You care about the Mavs, so it's easy for you to want the best for the Mavs. You care about the community, so it's easy for you to care about the secret is that you care enough to want to be great at it.
I mean, you can't ignore it, right? I'm sure, Russ, it's the same for you. I get letters and emails and calls. You know, there's some kid who's dying of cancer and he's a huge Russ fan, right? And, you know, he wants a signed jersey to be buried, or, you know, he's a huge Mavs fan and he wants to come to a game. Can we arrange that to happen? Or, you know, he's in the hospital and he's really, really sick with COVID. Can we send him Mavs gear just to cheer him up? Because his family can't go in there and see them. And these are the little things that you don't talk about, but that you do, because when you know, we're just in a very gifted position, very fortunate position to lift people up. And it doesn't have to be the big things, and it's not the things you talk about, and it's not the thing, but just lifting people up when they're really hurting, is just, to be able to do that is something special.
Yeah, you're so right. Who are your five, when you're speaking about that, like, obviously you've had amazing guys that you've gotten to, you know, be around and, you know, be a part of your team and everything else. Who would you say your top five guys are that you've played or you've worked with that have made a difference?
With, yeah. Yeah. Joey down at the gym, Billy down at the gym, top teammate ever.
But who are your top five? Who are your starting five in terms of the Dallas Mavs guys, the players that have had impact in the community, but also have obviously been great as well as players? Like, who are those guys that you can think of?
Like Dirk Nowitzki. I mean, still, just like you. Dirk, you know, Dirk will call up Children's Hospital Cancer Ward and say, I'm coming down. Can, you know, not, okay, can the Mavs set it up and let's bring some cameras? It's just like, I'm coming down to visit and I'm just going to show up, and he'll spend hours. I mean, it's crazy, right? I mean, just to be able to give his time like that. And he's been a big inspiration for me. And he does, you know, he has a charity baseball game. He has a charity tennis tournament. And he's just doing all these things with kids all the time. You know, Michael Finley, Steve Nash, guys that when I first came into league kind of taught me all these things, that it is a responsibility. And they had foundations. You know, I would go to the south side of Chicago with Michael Finley and work with the kids in his foundation and give a little – try to inspire them to do more. So those probably are the top three that really, you know, when I first bought the Mavs, really showed me the way and really set an example of what I wanted to accomplish, and they were great.
Well, I think this picture of legacy and impact, you know, especially in the community, both correlate, you know, and I think that for the greatest players and the people that I admire, one of the guys we just played actually this weekend against, this Thursday night against, the Arizona Cardinals. And one of my favorite guys in the NFL is Larry Fitzgerald, and just his impact obviously on the field and his legacy on the field, but his impact in the community. I think when those two things correlate, that's when you find these legends of the games, you know, that like
exactly. And Larry went to Pitt, called me up, and then emailed me when they were coming to Dallas and asked me to come and talk to the younger players to talk about financial responsibility. Just set it up on his own, and just over and over and over again, you hear stories like that about Larry. I mean, so you're exactly right. That's somebody that I think we all should look up to, because he's somebody special on the field and off.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite guys, and I know that obviously him playing at University of Pitt. And you know, I see you looking at your phone right now. I know free agency is going on right now. What's going on in free agency? Free agency is happening right now, just so you know, on Danger Talk. You know,
I got nobody right now. And you know, some people play fantasy sports. This is my fantasy sports, so I'm seeing if we got it. You know, because free agency started 40 minutes ago, and so you're the only guy that I would do this for when free agency started, Russ. You know that.
Hey, listen, I hear all this talk, but I'm still waiting for my 10-day contract. I'm still waiting.
You're my next call.
I've been a free agent. I've been a free agent for the past 5 years, Mark Cuban. I'm sitting here ready.
You know, Russ, I mean, we just drafted a point guard, but see, if I forgot, I should have been on top of my game. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all good. Me and Luca, we could be scoring points for you right now.
Yeah, you could, man. Luca's a real deal. He's amazing.
He is amazing. He's so smooth with this jump shot. It's incredible how he creates space. You know, he's so dominant. Who would you compare him to as a player? All the guys you've seen in your lifetime and everything else. Like, is there a player that you compare him to?
Magic Johnson.
Really?
Yeah, Magic Johnson. Yeah. Can pass the ball, can see over the top, can get where he wants on the court. Knows how to get, pass to a guy on time and on target. Loves to play crunch time. Will take on the responsibility of anybody, anytime. Great teammate, fun kid. You know, Magic would light things up right with a smile. Luka's the same way. He's got that charisma that Magic has.
Owns a Starbucks.
Owns a Starbucks. He'll get there. He's that smart. But Luke, you know, Gen Z kids are different, right? You know, even the millennials, right? They just got a different vibe about them and different interests. And so he's just on social media. He's lighting people up. He's lighting kids up wherever we're playing. He's spending time talking to kids, bringing kids on the court. It's just, he's got that charisma and that, and actually, you know, he's going to set his own path. I mean, his game's most like Magic Johnson, but his personality, I think, is almost even bigger than Magic Johnson's.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, one of the times I got to be around Magic, we were actually in Seattle, and he had this, as you mentioned, this charisma to him, and how he really engaged with young kids. And I really admired that, because I remember these young kids run up to me, and then they ran, that's Magic Johnson. And just how he embraced them, even though he's larger than life, I really admired that from him. And I just noticed that. And I see that all the time with Luca too, as well. And, you know, even though he's a younger guy, just his ability to still be at the highest level, but yet still be calm and still have fun and still be relaxed at all times.
He lets the game come to him, right? He's never rushed. You know, his rookie season a little bit, but he learned it very quickly. He's not rushed. And off the court, even during a game, right, if there's some little kid on, you know, that's up close and, you know, is just like in awe, he'll walk over, give him a high five, leave his shoes for him, bring a kid on the court in a pregame. That's just, you know, he's a kid, right? And he's having fun with the kids around him. And that kind of charisma, you know, you can't teach. When he walks into a room, he lights up the room, and people just are attracted to him. And you know, that's the foundation. If you have the skill and the charisma, who knows where it can go?
Well, Luke is definitely creating a legacy for himself, and it's really cool to watch. And he's one of my favorite players in the game right now, just because he can just create so much space and do so many cool things. And yeah, as you mentioned, his charisma is amazing on and off the court. And he's really, you know,
you'd be shocked right to how big he is. He's a legit 6'7", 240.
Crazy. He play tight end for us.
Yeah. Right. You know, I mean, he's legit. He's that big. And so, you know, he may not be the quickest other than his first step. He's not going to beat you in a foot race, but once he puts his body on you and gets just a little bit of an angle, he's by you and he's so strong. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. He's definitely going to be a legend in this game of NBA, obviously. And so as we're speaking about legacy, we do this thing here, Mark, where we dive into this session here. We're just one-on-one, me and you, talking about cooking with Russ. Yep. Okay, so we're about to do this cooking with Russ, where we talk about greatness, what it looks like, legacy, just how you got here today. Jeff's going to come back and do this fun two-minute drill and have some cool questions for you. But, you know, as we're talking about success and legacy and your upbringing, I love where people come from and what got you here today. And so what I'm fascinated by is your upbringing. I'm fascinated by, you know, obviously you grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You know, I'm assuming, you know, you're a Steelers fan. Are you a Steelers fan?
Yeah, I'm a Cowboys fan too, because I've lived here a long time, but I'm diehard Steelers all the way through and through.
Yeah. So who was your favorite Steeler of all time, first of all?
Probably Joe Green, because when I was real little, mm-hmm. right, he was finishing his career. That's like the first NFL guy that I knew about. And then Lynn Swann.
Yeah, there's some good ones for sure. My dad used to always talk about Joe Green and Lynn Swann. So in terms of, you know, your upbringing and just kind of how you got to where you are today, I'm fascinated because I think this entrepreneurial spirit, and when we were on the set of Entourage even, we kind of talked about this and just kind of some of the things that you were doing and some of the things I was thinking about and just where I want to go. And, you know, I want to be a multi-billionaire. I want to own a team one day. I want to be able to, you know, do all those different things that you've been able to do. And, you know, to be able to impact lives. I think that's what I'm really important, you know, and fascinated by and desiring. But I think back to, I love the history of kind of where you've come from. And I think about this imagery of you, you know, you sell, as a young kid, you know, selling garbage bags to pay for a pair of basketball shoes. I mean, you were selling garbage bags. Mark Cuban was selling, you know, garbage bags for shoes.
Yeah, absolutely. Like my dad did upholstery on cars, never, you know, you had a rip in your car seat, you brought it to where my dad worked. My mom did odd jobs growing up. My mom was young. She was 20 when I was born. I mean, we started off a little bit down, but then grew into middle class. But my dad was always about, you know, you're going to have to figure this out for yourself. And if you want something, you got to earn it. And I was into sports like a lot of kids. And I remember going to my dad when his buddies were over playing poker and probably trashed out of their mind, right? And walking in saying, you know, Dad, I need a new pair of basketball shoes. And he looks at my feet. He goes, do those shoes still work? And I'm like, yeah, well, if those still work, when you have a job, you can buy whatever you want. But until then, those shoes are your shoes. And one of his buddies was there. And he goes, I got a job for you. I'm like, I'm 12 years old. And he goes, I got these garbage bags that you can sell in the neighborhood. I'm like, cool, I want to get my shoes. This is how it went down. Hi, I'm your neighbor, Mark Cuban. Do you use garbage bags? I'll give you 100 garbage bags in a box for $6. And every time you need your garbage bags, you just call and I'll put them in the back of my wagon and I'll drag them down to you. No one said no. It was great. But the important thing was I learned to sell and it gave me confidence. You know, I could walk up to a door and feel confident that, you know, I'm going to get an answer and I'm going to make the sale. And that I was just able to build on that and build on. I went from garbage bags, trading cards, selling magazines door to door. Let me just tell you, once you can sell magazines door to door, you can do anything. Because, and again, anything I got all the way through my life, for that matter, I had to work for. You know, I had to pay for my own college. I had to do all those things. And so, you know, in the back of my mind, it was like, okay, you know, let's see where I can take this and how big I can do something. And I was always hustling and always had a bunch of side hustles going on and making money. But that gave me the confidence when I started starting companies to know that I can make something happen.
Well, I think the ability to be able to one, build your confidence, two, to be able to sell something. One, I always think something that people need. I think it's always fascinating because I think like, you know, you think about it as a young kid or even in a neighborhood of people, like everybody uses garbage bags. So it's like, here you go. And, there's another reason why they're not saying no, that they're saying always saying yes to you. But I also think that ability for you to be able to learn that at a young age because of your parent saying, no, son, like if you want new shoes, you got to earn them. And I think that's even in today's society, you know, and even for people like yourself and myself, it's one of those things that you have to teach your kids how to earn everything, you know? And
oh yeah. You know, especially now, because you face the same thing. My kids are 11, 14 and 17 now, and I don't want them to grow up to be entitled jerks. Right. I don't want them to think, oh, you know, I'll just fall off of daddy. I tell them all the time, I'm rich. You're not, yeah. You know, and the same lessons that my dad taught me, I'm going to teach you. I mean, my dad, literally, if I was in the shower too long, hot water, you know what my hot water bill is when the door swings open in the backyard, right? You know what my air conditioning bill is always. And so you don't forget those things. You know, that's how I grew up. And that just stays part of me. And, you know, my dad was a depression baby. My mom was a depression baby. My grandparents, even worse, right? They came over from Russia with nothing in their pockets. And so everybody around me was like that, that, you know, you got to work to get anything. And if you get to college and we're going to push you to get there, yeah, you're going to have to figure out how to pay for it, but you're going to have to work. And, you know, that confidence and that work ethic that they gave me has always really been important for me.
So is that something that you and Tiff, you know, have really instilled in your kids, you know, when you're thinking about Alexis and Jake and Alyssa, is that something that you've really focused on?
We tried, you know, it's just different, you know, kids, you know, little boys, little girls, and even 11, 14 and 17, you know, we were so sports driven growing up, right. You know, was dominated by sports, whether you were good or not, right. You were the athlete. I was just loving sports, but now, you know, with the devices and everything, you got to work harder. You know, we try to sit down with them. But we really try to help them set goals, and it doesn't work on everything, but I think they also see my wife and I do things, whether it's the foundation work or other things that we're doing, or whether it's me working, you know, doing the companies and everything. And I try to really always have talked to them like adults, even when they were younger, to try to explain everything that's going on. And I think it's giving them hopefully a foundation for them to realize they have to work hard in order to accomplish things for themselves.
Yeah, for sure. So going back to your childhood, you're, you know, in high school and everything else, and the next thing you know, you skip your senior year of high school to go to college early. You know, why was that? Can you walk us through that?
Yeah. You know, when I was a junior in high school at Mount Lebanon High School in Pittsburgh, at that point I knew I want to be into business, right? And my high school only had one business class that was only available to seniors, and I was a junior. So I'm like, I'm going to, you know, see if I can sneak into college and sign up at the University of Pittsburgh for a class. And I didn't know if they would let me, but they let me. So I took, I had to take a psychology class and a writing class before I was able to take the other class. And I did pretty well. So I was like, okay, you know, I'm 16 and I'm pulling this college thing and I got this. So I just didn't go back to high school my senior year. I went to the University of Pittsburgh, joined a fraternity, Pi Lambda Phi, slept down there, did my thing down there, thought I was a big shot. But Pitt didn't really have an undergrad business school. So from there, I knew I was going to have to transfer. So saw a list of the top 10 business schools, picked out the cheapest one. Never had seen the campus and went to Bloomington, Indiana, to Indiana University.
Yeah. I knew that you went to Indiana, which was pretty cool to think about. But you had a vision of business and entrepreneurship and ownership ever since you were a young kid. Obviously, you owned the garbage bags, you owned the magazines, you owned knocking on the door and selling, you owned all this space, and you had this love of sports. Obviously, coming from Pittsburgh, you gotta love sports, you gotta love ball. But yeah. Obviously, you've always loved sports, and you've always done that. So, but what drove you to decide to purchase the Mavericks, and how did you get there? First of all, like what was the thing that let you get there? Because I'm fascinated by this, because I want to be able to own an NFL team one day. I want to be able to own an NBA team one day, a Major League Baseball team too, as well, potentially. And so, for me, how'd you get there?
So we'll talk about whether you should own a baseball team. That's a whole different conversation. Yeah. But so when I got down to Dallas after Indiana, I got a job at night as a bartender, started working during the day, and then I got a job selling software, got fired from that job, realized I was a lousy employee, started a software company. 7 years later, no vacation, sold it for $6 million, ended up with a couple million. And then I retired because I just wanted to party like a rock star, bought a lifetime pass in American Airlines and just did it up. And then a buddy from Indiana and I got together, and he was like, this was 1990, late 94, early 95. And he's like, look, this whole new internet thing is going on, and there's got to be a way that we can use it to listen to Indiana basketball, because here we are in Dallas and we can't get the games. And I'm like, okay, let me see if I can figure something out. So that's where we started this company called AudioNet, which was the first streaming company. It was literally the first company to do, we called it netcasting back then. And so we got it to start working, and we created this website called AudioNet. And I would go all around the internet, wherever I could find people, and say, if you're into Dallas anything, come check out this website. And just bam, it started to take off. And then we added video, changed the name to broadcast.com, went public, had the biggest IPO in the history of the stock market at the time. And then we sold it to Yahoo, protected my stock, sold my stock, and I was a Mavs season ticket. So I'm going through, this is the blur version, right? This is the flash version. So 99-2000 season, I just collared all my stock that I got from Yahoo. So I knew I was gonna have that B next to my name. And I'm a Mavs season ticket holder. And I'm there with my then girlfriend, now wife, Tip. And we're sitting there watching the game, and I'm looking around. I'm like, dude, we're undefeated. Then there's no energy. There's, you know, it's half empty. We got Sean Bradley on our team, right? How is this place not fired up and ready to go? And I'm like, oh, wait, I can do a better job than this. Why don't I see if I can buy this team? Never crossed my mind before that. And so Mark Aguirre, who was one of the all-time great Mavs, right? I saw him, introduced myself. No, I talked to my sales rep, who introduced me to Mark Aguirre, who introduced me to Ross Perot Jr., the owner. And that was like first week in November. By the end of November, middle of December, we're talking a deal. And by the first week of January, I had bought the Mavericks. And why did I buy them? I just love basketball. Man, I've been like I said, that first job was to get basketball shoes. To this day, like, you know, I would be playing pickup if it wasn't for the pandemic, and I have a little court outside, and to clear my head, I'll go out there and shoot. And I just got to tell you, the second best part, other than winning the championship, that trophy back there, is before home games, I get to go out on our court, and 3:30 till 4:30, 5 o'clock, when the guys start coming out, I just get to get up shots, listen to music. And that's how I clear my head to this minute, right? I mean, if I'm stressed and I just need to clear my head and block everything out, that sound of the ball going through the net, right? To me, that's nirvana. That's the best sound ever. And, I'll play basketball as long as I can walk. You know, as long as you can get me on the court, just being able to take some kid who was half my age and just shoot one shot. You know, the old man, the older you get, the further back, and you play those old man games. I don't care. I'll be out there till I'm 90 years old playing pickup or doing whatever. It's just part of me. And that's why I bought the Mavs.
Well, I love this idea, this visual for you as you're sitting there in the game. You know you're about to be a billionaire. You're sitting there, all this stuff's going on. And you're like, dang, like, where's the passion at? Like, just where's the energy? And I think for you, you've completely have reversed and changed that culture there, which is absolutely amazing as an owner to be able to do that. And kudos to you.
Well, I had a good German guy to help me too. I just happened to be there and not screw it up too many times, right? Yeah, so having Dirk really made a huge difference, and he deserves all the credit.
Yeah, Dirk was amazing, just his ability to shoot, man. He shoots that moon ball. It's like, you know, he goes right into the basket, man. It's amazing.
It's not even a normal shot. He shoots with two fingers on the ball, right? And no spin. Everybody always gets taught, you know, the follow through and get the spin. Two fingers, no spin, goes in.
It's incredible, you know? how much height he puts on that ball. Just let it drop in. And I noticed that even for my deep balls when I throw, it's because I went to go see him play, and I was like, man, it makes it, it gives you that really good angle for that ball to have a chance to go in. And so
and you know what? The physics. So the guy who's his trainer, Holger Gershwanger, he actually gave me a book on the physics of shooting. And the higher the shot, the more of the hoop is available to you, the wider the rim is to the ball. And so that's all planned and that's all science. And he would tell you that it's all about the physics of basketball.
Well, it's definitely one of the things I've thought about in terms of passing the ball too, because as the ball comes in and approaches, it gives the guy the greatest chance to make a reaction on the ball, which I think is always fascinating. Obviously, you own the Mavericks free agency. Any news on free agency right now?
And you know what? I can't give you the player's name, but he's asking if we'll consider the full mid-level.
Oh, come on now.
Let me text back.
If we get some action, let us know. Let us know.
I know.
But you know, as we think about just
not yet on the board.
No, it's good. It's I'm loving this. I feel like I'm in the draft room right now, in the midst of it all.
And draft rooms are crazy.
I know, right? It's wild. But as you talk about, you know, you owning the Mavs and that experience, that feeling, that rush of owning a team. I know you've also wanted to own NHL, Major League Baseball teams. You know, is that something you still want to do, or what was that?
No, I mean, when I was first getting started, I looked at it because I liked the idea of having multiple teams. Then when I started having kids and they got to the age where they were really fun, then it got less appealing. You know, 162 games for baseball. Could you imagine? I'd be dead. You know, it's just, yeah. Cause I mean, if you got to love the game, first of all, you can't just look at it as a business because I mean, you know how, you know, Paul was a great owner, right? I mean, Paul was a different kind of dude, right? But he had a heart of gold and was one of the best owners in all of sports. And, you know, you just tell how into it he was and how hard it is, you know, to be part of it. Doing more than one team, I don't know how he did it, right? You know, maybe because football is only 16 games in playoffs, but 162 games and hopefully playoffs, I'd be dead. Yeah, there's just no way. I grew out of that real fast.
Well, I'm a huge baseball fan just because playing it my whole life, but I love sports as a whole. It doesn't matter if it's football, basketball, soccer, baseball. I just love the team setting and the energy. I just love it when fans are so connected. Obviously, we're part of the Sounders ownership in Seattle with soccer, and you know, we went on our own baseball team, and we're trying to bring the Sonics back. Which, first of all, we need to talk about the Sonics because
I'm there for you. I voted against them leaving, so I'm right there with you. I think we need a team there.
We do. I mean, for everybody listening here, don't you think? I mean, Seattle's like the best place. If anywhere needs basketball, it's Seattle. Just the tradition of basketball in Washington's amazing, but we need to fight for that. You know, Mark, you and I need to go together to bat. You know, for basketball.
I'm already there. I've already talked about it. If we expand, you know, there's a couple cities, and Seattle's probably right at the top of the list.
Yeah, I mean,
I can't say where we're going to expand. I just don't know.
Yeah, the tradition of basketball here has been so fascinating, so amazing. So hopefully, we can get the Sonics back right here in Seattle. You guys heard?
You know, what's the name of the Paulson, right? Merritt, is it Merritt Paulson that owns part of the Sounders?
I'm not sure. It sounds familiar.
Yeah, okay. Anyways, but you guys do, the Sounders do a great job, right? They do a great job marketing to the fans and everything, but you know, it takes so much energy and so much emotional capital. It, you know, you got to pick one.
Yeah, so Adrian Hanauer, he owns most of the Sounders, and we do, and Paul Volkan still does, and so we have a pretty good, you know, widespread ownership of the Sounders. It's pretty cool, our group, and it's been Terry Meyerson and the team. So it's been really cool. Ken Griffey just joined in. So we got a really in-depth and cool group.
Now, if you're just going to be a minority owner, then it's cool, yeah. Right? If you're just going to be a minority owner, then you just have fun with it, right? Yeah. Then it's just about going to the games and pairing it up and being part of it. You know, when you got to look at the text to see if, you know, if you're making the trade, that's a whole different beast, man, because that just consumes you. You know, because you know what it's like. I mean, you, at the quarterback, nobody feels more pressure than you do, you know, and every single game is on the line. But the minute that season's over, then it flips to the other side, right, to ownership and management. And, you know, if it was easy, everybody would do it. But it's not the easiest thing in the world. And so you got to really – it's a commitment. I'm setting you up, man. I want you to do it. I know you can get there. I'm just preparing you.
You know, listen, I'm 31 years old. I'm fired up to get there. I would love to own the, you know, Seattle Seahawks one day. Just the city is so special,
yeah, it was amazing.
You know? And so I really obviously love football and just being a part of it. And, you know, I know how to, you know, I've been around some great teams, you know, and some great organizations, and obviously Seattle being with our culture here and how we run things. And then also, you know, how Paul used to run them. And I used to have some really, you know, Paul was a quiet guy, but I got to know him in a pretty in-depth way. Me and him, we spent a lot of time together one-on-one, which was really cool before he passed away. And I know Jody's doing an amazing job with the team. And now she's also doing the Blazers too as well, which that tradition and that energy in that stadium is amazing. So
I was really disappointed. I was really disappointed because when Jody took over, I was hoping she'd be no good. And she's been really good because I just want to kick their ass every time when we play the Blazers. But she's done a great job. She deserves a ton of credit.
Yeah, she's done an amazing job with them. And so it's been cool just to see just the passion around it. So I would love to own the Seattle Seahawks one day. That would be one of my biggest goals in life. You know, you have some goals and things you want to do. You know, and I think that
There's no reason why you can't. I mean, absolutely no reason why you can't get there.
Yeah, it would be cool. You know, it would be cool to be. I think also too to be a black owner, you know, of a major sports team, you know, and to, you know, to own an NFL team like the Seattle Seahawks would be a really, really special thing. You know, I think that's very rare, obviously, and so to be able to do something like that would, for me and Sierra, we've definitely talked about that many a time. So I'll have to pick your brain some more when we get some one-on-one this offseason.
I'm here for you anytime.
So, you know, as you think about ownership and everything else too, you've obviously, there's obviously the pros of everything and all the things that, you know, that you get to do and all the fun. But you've also, you know, unfortunately you've been criticized for at times for being a very vocal owner, you know, at times even. So, you know, you have those people that love you, hate you, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, what do you have to say to those people that criticize the process of it all? Because you do want to be yourself. So what's your thought process on that?
Right. I mean, look, I am who I am, right? I don't pretend. This is how I've always been. You know, and when I got to the NBA and bought the Mavs, everybody was like, go sit up in the suite and write the checks and shut up. And I'm like, no, I didn't bust my ass to get here to just, you know, I love this game. I want to be right there on the court, right? And I want to be part of all of it. And to me, that's just who I am. And when people didn't like that, I got all kinds of grief. All kinds of grief from everyone everywhere. But over time, as people got more and more used to me, it's been less of an issue. Yeah, I still yell at the refs. You know, everybody's got something where that just, you know, turns them the wrong way or whatever. For me, I don't know what it is. Like when I played, I never yelled at the ref. You know, it for whatever reason, you get me during a game and I'm just screaming at the refs, and that's my stress release during the game. But beyond that, you know, I do my best and I try to be honest and I try to do the best for the fans and for the team and for the guys and put everybody in position to succeed. And not everybody's going to agree with my approach. And, you know, I understand that.
Well, I love just seeing you in the front row and just the energy. As I mentioned earlier, I got to sit up in the front row with you and just how much fun we had and just watching the game, how much energy there is. But also you got other owners like, you know, Steve Ballmer, for example, who's so passionate. Anybody who knows Steve, it's like, he is so into the game, into every moment. Yeah, his face gets red when he's screaming and so excited. You know, you think about, you know, when I think about, you know, obviously Paul being away now, but he used to sit in the front row and he'd sit back relaxed and watching the game, and he'd throw a fist pump there every once in a while. Jody, super energetic. Yeah, you know, Jerry Jones is in every moment.
Remember, before, though, there was Jerry in football, right? But before I got to the NBA, there was no other owners. I was in an NBA board meeting one time, and one of the old school owners who's long gone now started just giving me the hardest time. You MF'er, what have you ever done in this league? Sit down and shut the F up. We don't need to hear from you ever. And David Stern, rest in peace, David, he was awesome, just looks and just relax. And I was just like, look, this is who I am, right? You know, I earn my money. This is my team, you know, for better or worse. And, you know, but things have changed. You know, one of the highlights for me as an owner, when Michael Jordan bought the team, they were like, what kind of owner do you want to be? And he was like, I want to be like Mark Cuban. I'm going to be involved. And Michael sits right next to the bench and he's involved with the players, obviously. And, you know, he brings his leadership to his team as well. And, you know, everybody's got to do it their own way. You know, Ballmer goes nuts. And it's just, I'm glad to see it, because if you're not a fan, you should not be owning a team. If this is just, you know, the guys or women who own teams and it's just a business proposition for them, they don't do well. And people recognize that it's just business, and it always backfires on you, always.
Well, I don't think people understand the relationship between ownership and the players and how connected that should be, because that's when you have not only the people you draft who want to play for you, but honestly, as you're sitting here in free agency, it makes players want to come to you. It makes players want to play for Mark Cuban. It makes players want to play for the Dallas Mavs. And speaking of a player, we may have one that just may be an option for you here.
Yeah, almost.
Almost there.
Now the free agency starts. You know, free agency is a lot like the NFL too, right? So all the agents, you know, try to gear the market and set expectations for the players. And you talk to all the different teams. It's like when you were going through the draft and free agency, right? And you talk to all the different teams and like, yeah, we like your guy. And if he's there, or, you know, we think we're going to have this amount of money and we'll think we'll be able to pay them. But the minute the clock strikes one, right, or in this case five, and everything starts, then the money starts drying up, because this team took this guy. And the agents start to get frantic. So we're not to frantic mode yet, but we're getting there. And then teams lose guys that they thought that they would have, that they thought they had the right amount and had, you know, we're going to be able to make an offer to and get it accepted. And then you lose some of those guys. So teams start getting a little frantic. So the anxiety levels go boom, 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 boom. And I love this stuff, right? This is where I get to, you know, be sitting back in the pocket, looking downfield, seeing what's open, what's not open, dealing with the rush, and, you know, and just taking the hits and trying to make the right play.
Well, I think that, you know, it's obviously, you know, as you think about those relationships and, you know, as players get excited to come play for you, and obviously these agents getting frantic, it's such an amazing thing when the clock hits a certain moment, everybody gets like, oh, well, I thought this was going to happen. What's your panic level, right? Do you get nervous, or you get just super calm in the moment?
Oh, I get nervous.
You do?
No, I get nervous, right? I definitely get nervous, but I know all my options, yeah. Right? So nervous probably isn't the right word, but I, you know, I feel it, and I know what I'm going to do with these set of circumstances. So if this happens, I know exactly what I'm going to do. If that happens, I know exactly what I'm going to do. And you go down your reads, right? And you know how much time you have, and you make your decision. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't work and you don't get what you want because you had to go big, you know, because that was the only thing that was going to help our team. And sometimes you do. And that's kind of how I go through it all.
Do you ever worry about your relationships with your players in terms of how connected you are to the players?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If you have to cut a guy, for example, or release a guy or trade a guy, you ever worry about that relationship? Or are you more so focused on, you know what? If I have a good, really, really good rapport and relationship with this player, no matter what happens, yes, this is business and all that, but I'm always going to look out for you. I'm always going to try to send you to a good place. Like what is that tight-knit relationship like and the balance of it?
It goes both ways, right? You know, in some cases you get close to players and you trade them and it hurts to trade them because they're your friend, you know? But they understand that, you know, it's part of the business, but it doesn't mean they'll like it. Right. And yeah, without question, there's been players that, you know, there's been animosity towards me or, you know, because I got to know them and, you know, then we did a deal. But, you know, the thing about this is, you know, as you know, right, you know, no one plays forever, you know, and there's going to be a point where your life outside of basketball is going to be more of your life than your life inside of football or basketball. Right. You know, even with Dirk, who played 21 years with us, you know, he's going to have a lot more time outside of the court than on the court. And so I think even if things go a little bit sour, I try to have relationships with guys so that they recognize that I'm loyal to them once they come back. Michael Finley, you know, we amnestied Michael Finley from the Mavs as a financial move. And he was upset, really, really mad. And then 4 years, 5 years later, after he retired, he called me up and said, Mark, I want to get into the game. Can you help me out? And I said, Finn, you got a job for life, right? You helped train me. You helped, you know, help me understand the game when I first bought my team. And yes, you have a job. What do you want to do? You know, and when you start developing those types of relationships, you know, now that I've been doing this for 20 years, I get to see the other side of it. When I was just getting started, and I would get upset because guys were upset because they were my friends. But, you know, now over time, I get to see now I can help them more after the game than I ever could in the game, because that's, you know, and you see it with athletes all the time. That's harder, right? You've trained all your life to be a professional athlete. And as much as you want to do all these other things, you know, the average career in football is 2-3 years, right? The average career in basketball is 4 years, give or take. And, you know, what do you do after that time is up? You know, and it's difficult for players. And I try to be there for all our legacy guys, guys who have, you know, played for a year or two that I got to know or more.
Well, that's such a real perspective because, you know, so many of us athletes, and all of us really, we spend so much of our life from 5 years old to 35 years old to 40 years old for some guys. I mean, sometimes even 42, 43 for some guys. You get to talk about a guy like Dirk who played 21 years, but you spend your whole life training and perfecting your craft, and then boom. Like, how do you get prepared for life afterwards? And I think that's for you to be able to be so invested into the relationships of, hey, I'm here for you for life. What can I do? How can I create those opportunities and everything else? And just having that business venture mindset and to be able to create so many opportunities. And I love one of my favorite shows that you're on, obviously Shark Tank, and just all the business ventures you've done. But you've been on Shark Tank for so long. What do you enjoy about Shark Tank? And just what's your favorite part of the show, Shark Tank? Because it's one of my favorite shows.
You mean Friday night on ABC, Shark Tank, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central? That's that sales background.
Yep.
What I like best about the show is it teaches kids about business, and it gives them confidence to be entrepreneurs and gives them guidelines and directions on how to start a company and be an entrepreneur no matter how old you are. And it happened, you know, pre-pandemic, it would happen all the time where people would come up to me, oh my God, we watched Shark Tank as a family, and my son or my daughter started this company that does this or that. I had one lady come up to me, and I forget if it was her son or daughter that was like in sixth grade, and she was like, oh my goodness, my son, daughter, whatever, sold $100,000 in slime. Now, I have a son, so I knew what slime was, but $100,000? I mean, that was crazy. And it was like, we watched Shark Tank, and you inspired him to go do this. And now that we've been on, oh my goodness, 12 seasons. It's like all these kids that are telling us they grew up. Like now you're starting to hear about kids who said they grew up watching you in Seattle, right? Yeah. And you start to get that, oh my goodness. And so it's on Shark Tank, I grew up watching you, and I started a company because, you know, I learned about business because of Shark Tank. That's why I do it. Because we, you know, to me, I want people to feel like the American dream is alive and well. And that's harder for a lot of people. Not everybody has the same opportunities. And if we can take somebody who may not have had that, you know, as good an opportunity to start a business or do business or go to school, and we inspire them to go out and try something, that's a beautiful thing. And so that's really why I do the show.
So when you're listening to a pitch, for example, and you're just listening to a really cool pitch on Shark Tank, what are the key elements you're looking for? And then, you know, what are the immediate red flags that you're looking for? If someone's like, that's not a good idea, or this shows up, like, what are those few things?
So the first thing I look for is if they make me say, why didn't I think of that? Mm. Right? Because I'm an entrepreneur, right? And I have that little bit of arrogance thinking, okay, I've got ideas coming all the time. And if someone walks in there and pitches us, and I'm like, oh my goodness, what a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? That's number one. Number two, can they sell? Because there's never been a company that's ever existed that doesn't have sales. So you have to be able to sell. And if it's your company, you created it, and you don't think your product is so amazing, you love to sell it, then it's not going to work. And three, you know, are they a good person? Do they like to work? Do they like to learn? Because can they deal with uncertainty? Because the only certainty in business is change. There's going to be new competition. There's going to be new technology. There's going to be a pandemic. Who knows what's going to come at you? And if you can't be resilient and agile, then you're not going to be able to be effective. And so those are the things I really look for. And then the fourth is, can I help them? You know, there's going to be certain products where there's nothing I can do, right? I just don't have whatever it may be. And if I can help them, then chances are, and they check all those boxes, chances are I'm going to go after it.
Yeah, that's an awesome description, because I think for anybody who wants to be able to create like that. So what's been your favorite memorable Shark Tank pitch? Do you have one?
Yeah, there's so many of them. I had a guy, Tower paddle boards. They sell stand up paddle boards. And this guy came in and just crashed and burned on his pitch, literally sweating, stammering, just couldn't get it out. But when I asked him questions, his answers were amazing. He knew everything. He knew everything he needed to know. And the product stand up paddle board was just starting to happen. And so I knew it was going to be a decent business and had a chance. And the guy really understood how to sell on the internet. And I was like, all the other sharks were like, oh, this guy just screwed up. I'm like, no, this guy's amazing. And I think I gave him $100,000 or something for 30% of the company. And he sold millions and tens of millions of dollars worth of product and paid me back millions of dollars. And even though it's not my biggest deal, just I was proud of Stephen because he went from something that looked like it was an absolute dumpster fire and was able to convey just how good he was and produce. I mean, a lot of people can talk the talk, but this guy walked the walk, and that was special.
So what's that paddleboard company called? I got this beautiful lake out here in Seattle. I need some new paddleboards. What's it called?
It's called Tower Paddleboards.
Tower Paddleboards. All right, I'm to order some.
Done. Or just hit me up and I'll take care.
Yeah,
of
I'll hit you up. We'll slap some logos on there. Have some fun with it. But you know, how do you also handle how do you handle the ones that like get away? Like, have you ever seen one that's like, should I pull the trigger? Should I not? And the next thing you know, like, okay, I'll pass on this one. And then you're pissed off because you this is one you didn't get.
Only one. Well, two of them. There was one spike ball came on. Yep. And I kept on going back and forth. I'm like, oh, my kids will have fun with this. I'll have fun with it. Worst case, good exercise. Then I was like, it was just one of those days where like, no, I don't want to deal with it. So spike ball blew up. And then the other one was this thing called cozy comforters, right? And there's just this big, comfy, pillowy, you know, blankety type thing that you just put over you and just makes you. And so I'm thinking it'll go okay, but maybe not. Barbara did the deal. And she's not made millions of dollars. She's made tens of millions. They've sold hundreds of millions of dollars worth of those things.
Well, I need to get some of those too. I mean, so what's the feeling of like, you know, you miss out? Is it just, does it piss you off? Or is it like, dang, like how did I miss on that?
It would piss me off. Like I missed out on Uber. Like really? The guy, Travis, who started Uber, I funded his previous company, Red Swoosh. And I've mentored this kid. I mean, you know, and just helped him. And when he started it as Uber cab, he sent me an email and I'm like, yo, you're going to have this problem. I'll invest, but you've got to work with me here. Never heard back from him. Got these big investors in Silicon Valley and the rest is history.
So you missed out on
that. I was a little bit pissed off because I had helped him and he never came back to me, but water under the bridge.
So you missed on Uber. That's crazy. Yeah. So everyone obviously talks about the good investments and just what would you say has been your worst investment?
A couple of them. So when I first came on the show, first came on the show, there is this company and I don't want to throw them under the bus, but effectively they spent all their money trying to get these global patents. And then he ran out of money and I wouldn't give him any more because I told him not to do it. And then he was going nowhere. And I sat down with them. And I said, look, I'll do all the work because I own 33% of the company. I'll do all the work. Just let me take over the website, take care of all of it. You still own 2/3 of the company, but I think it's that good a company. He was like, yeah, okay, let's do it. So I'm doing it all. I got my guys doing all the work. Business is going bam, 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 bam. And then all of a sudden, one of my guys comes up to me. You're not going to believe what Doug did. I'm like, what did Doug do? Doug created his own competing website. So he created a website to compete with a website that I was doing all the work and he was finally going to make some money and he just couldn't get out of his own way. And then 4 years later, 5 years later, I called him up because I still think it's a great idea. And I said, would you sell it to him? And he goes, yeah, I want $5 million or some ridiculous amount when they have like $60,000 in sales. So sometimes you just get an entrepreneur that just can't get it together and it happens. And you know, there's more than one story like that, but it happens. You're going to have some that are stinkers.
So what's the feeling of knowing in the process for you? Because I'm an investor, obviously, and me and Sierra, and we've been fortunate to invest in some really great companies in the process of all things. But that risk reward for the young investors, like to, you know, for example, my sister's coming out of college right now, you know, and she's just graduated from Stanford. And you know, what would you tell my sister, wow, for example, for somebody who's, you know, so business oriented, has a great mind, young, but also for those who are learning to invest and everything else, that risk reward relationship of, and what would, right, you, what would you get? What nugget would you give for taking a risk and what and not?
So two different things, right? So if you're coming out of school, doesn't matter if it's Stanford or, you know, Dallas Community College, right? Don't look for the perfect job. There is no perfect job. You spent your time in school paying to learn. Now, when you go out and get a job, you're going to get paid to learn. Or you started out paying to learn in school. Now you're going to get paid to learn, right? And don't, you know, you're a free agent. Don't look for a career. Look for a job where no matter what you're doing, you'll be able to learn something. I don't care if you work at McDonald's. You'll learn how McDonald's operates a franchise. I don't care if you work at a job that you don't see any future for you. I learned more from the job I got fired from and what not to do than from companies I worked with that I thought were well-run companies. And so when you're just getting started, just go out and get that first job. Try to be great at it, because you never know. You might walk into something that not only do you like, but you can be really good at. And once you're good at somebody, nobody quits anything they're great at. So take different chances. Don't try to get the perfect job. Go out there and try different things. And slowly but surely, if you work really hard to be good at those jobs, you're going to find yourself successful. And eventually you'll walk into that job where you go, this is me. This is exactly the job I want. And then you'll stay there for as long as you need to, or you'll start a company doing the same thing. Now, in terms of investing, you know, you've got to, it always comes down to trust. Like, do you trust yourself to do all the work to figure out if this is a good investment? Have you done your homework, right? Being a good investor is no different than being a good quarterback. You know, there's a lot of talented people that think they can play. There's a lot of super gifted athletic people that think, you know, because they're athletic, that's all they need. And then there's the people with vision and understand the work that's involved, and the people who can process information to make decisions in split seconds. It's the same in investing, right? You've got to be able to do your homework. You know, what do you know about the industry? What do you know about the people? How are you, how much money are you putting at risk? What's the upside? You know, how good are these people actually that you're working with? Because when someone's asking you to invest, no one walks up to you and asks for an investment and says, Russ, I'm an idiot, but give me your money because I want your money to start this company. They all are going to tell you how amazing they are. And so if you're going to be the investor yourself and do the work yourself, you really need to be prepared and do all the work. If you're not that person, then you need to find somebody that you really trust. You know, somebody who is that person that does all the work, because they're going to have the deal flow. They're going to be able to do all the due diligence that you may not be prepared to do. And if you find somebody really good and, hey, you know, let's bring Russ and Thierry in, then that's great. But you've got to really make sure that you can trust those people and they know what they're doing, because athletes in particular, that's where they go wrong. You know, they listen to a friend or somebody that they've known for their entire life, and they have this deal or that deal. And, you know, you think, okay, this sounds like it could work, but they're not really prepared to do the work. And just like sports, whoever you're investing in, and if you're doing the investing, preparation is everything.
Well, I think that's a great point. I've always thought about too, as well as, you know, is, you know, going back to what you kind of talked about, even with Shark Tank, for example, is, you know, this idea is there a wow factor? It's like, man, why didn't I think of that? Or, you know, has this ever been done before? You know, and those are the things that are sometimes worth taking the risk on, because those are the.
Yeah. Now, if you as an investor have a vision and all those due diligence check marks are checked, mm-hmm, right, then absolutely. If there's something you think that's like, wow, this is something special. Again, either you or somebody has got to do the due diligence and get to a point where you trust it. But once you get there, then yeah, absolutely. That's where you dive in. And, you know, I think where people make mistakes is they don't really understand what a win is, right? You know, so if you put in $25,000, which is a lot of money, you're not going to turn that into $20 million unless it's one in a billion type deal. You know, your $25,000, it's a good investment if it turns into 50,000, but you may have to wait 5, 6, 7 years to get a double. If it turns into $250,000 and it's a 10X, that's incredible. But $250,000 is a lot more money than 25,000, but it's not all of a sudden you're super rich, right? And so, and not all your deals are going to work. So, and I think like kind of the approach you take and others, you've got to be able to take your, you take your investing and kind of build a portfolio approach where you have multiple deals so that, you know, if 10% of them really hit, then you'll be okay. And that'll cover your losses, but also give you a good return.
No, I think it's a brilliant point and just the diversification of it all and to be able to, you know, spread it. I think you bring up a great point about athletes in particular and entertainers is that the reality is, you know, most athletes, most entertainers don't have help, don't have somebody that's really, really been strategic for them and to know that they can trust that person fully, but also have been educated. And also, I always tell my teammates and athletes is that it's so important that that financial person or whoever's in your world, have they done a big deal before? Have they done other, have they seen other big deals? Do they really know? Like, yeah. Because sometimes people are like, oh, yeah, I can help you. Okay, well, what have you done? Tell me more.
You're exactly right.
Tell me what you've done. And I think that the people's lineage and history of success for guidance and advice is really critical along the way. And I think it's an important, you know, aspect of running business and having a strategic business too.
Yeah, well, exactly right. I mean, you don't want to be a guinea pig, you know, and you don't want to be your money that you're testing somebody to see if they're any good, right? Because the odds are against you. But you're exactly right, Russ. You know, if someone's got a track record and you have the opportunity to work with them, then, you know, that's a beautiful thing. Because smart people tend to do smart things. If you get caught in between and it's somebody that maybe hasn't had the level of success, then, you know, or no experience, then it obviously gets much more difficult.
Yeah, so important. Well, listen, let me do this ad read real fast, Mark. 'Tis the season for giving and to celebrate the start of the most joyous time of the year. DraftKings, the leader in one-day fantasy sports, is giving all users a shot at their $25 million Thanksgiving giveaway. That's right. A share of up to $25 million in prizes is up for grabs this Thursday. Getting your share of up to $25 million in prizes is easy. All you have to do is enter one of DraftKings' paid Thanksgiving football contests and feast on your instant prize. It's simple. Just pick your lineup, stay under the salary cap, and see how your team stacks up against the competition. Feel the sweat like never before. Every run, pass, and catch means more with DraftKings. With DraftKings, payday comes every day for players. So join the action and get your share of up to $25 million. Easy as pie. Download the DraftKings app now and use code DANGERTALK. For a limited time, all users can get a share of $25 million in prizes this week. Don't miss out on Thursday's action. Enter code DANGERTALK and get a share of $25 million in instant prizes when you enter a paid football contest on Thanksgiving. That's code Danger Talk, only at DraftKings. Make it rain. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. My guy, Mark Cuban, here right now on Danger Talk, and we're having some fun here just talking about just everything that we have going on. And I think Jeff Dye, Jeff, you still there? Are you coming back to us right now? I think Jeff Dye may be coming back.
You better believe it. I didn't go anywhere, baby.
Oh, there he is.
Watching, listening, learning. I'm about to pitch you guys my ideas, but we don't have time.
Yeah, you know, we have to get you on Shark Tank, Jeff Dye, you know, and see if you...
I've got tons of ideas, you know. I've got I think we should invest, bring Hollywood Video back, Blockbuster Video, video stores. That's what we need. That's the future.
You are a visionary, Jeff. I can see it. You are a visionary.
He is a visionary, I got some visions of my own that I can pitch you on Shark Tank on our little side text here, Mark Cuban. I got something for you. But, you know, as we talk about this and everything else going on, you know, I think, Jeff, first of all, what did you learn something from us here in our Cooking with Russ session that you have a question about real fast?
Every time, man. When I listen to you talk, you always have someone successful on. You don't bring no scrubs on this podcast, which I appreciate. I do want to know more about I always like learning about the person before they were famous or before they were a billionaire or before they were a millionaire. I want to know what posters were on your wall when you were a young Mark Cuban.
That's a great question. I had a poster that I had college. And then when I got to Dallas, when I finally got my own room and it said, poverty sucks. That was my poster. And it had this Lamborghini and some dude holding a glass of champagne, and that was it. That was my motivation, man. Poverty sucks. I hated being broke. I hated eating mustard and ketchup sandwiches. I hated being at the grocery store at midnight waiting for the chicken to go down in price. You know, I just wanted to get out of that. And so, you know, that was my poster.
I love it. Poverty sucks. You guys hear that? So I think that's an amazing, you know, thought process for you to overcome, because obviously you didn't grow up with much, you know, Mark. And for you also to tell us you're selling garbage bags, you know, I don't know. Jeff Dye, can you sell garbage bags door to door? I mean, can you get that done?
No way, man. I mean, I would follow people around with their empty Coke bottles and I'd be able to get 5 cents a bottle. And I'd follow them even while they were drinking, going, hey, come on, when are you going to drop that? I need that nickel.
You do. You're a comedian. You're on stage, you know, every week, you know, telling great jokes and stuff.
Getting those nickels, right?
It's true.
Yeah, he's into penny stocks, you know. He's into penny stocks, you know, Mark.
I try to invest small and make a bunch, you know. He said $25,000 and that's not going to make you millions, but I'm a dreamer, baby. So that's I believe you can. I tell everyone listening, you can.
One big one.
Speaking of one big one, did you ever do a bunch of stuff into Bitcoin or anything, Mark Cuban?
I've owned some Bitcoin over time. I'm not against Bitcoin, even though I like, so on Twitter, right? Twitter's like Bitcoin heaven. And I love to give a hard time to all the Bitcoin freaks, right? And so one time I did an interview where I compared Bitcoin to bananas. I'm like, look, what can you do with Bitcoin? You can't really spend it anywhere. It doesn't serve any purpose. I'll buy bananas. I can eat a banana. I can sell bananas. I can trade bananas, which is true. Gold. I'm like, if the economy goes to hell, are you really going to carry around gold bars? No, you're going to carry around bananas because you're hungry, but you're not going to carry around gold bars because it's just hard to do. And Bitcoin's kind of the same thing, but it doesn't matter, right? The beauty of Bitcoin is it's just a supply and demand thing. It, you know, it's no different than gold or it's a little bit different than gold, but in that there's a finite amount of Bitcoin and they're only going to make 21 million of them. And as long as people aren't really using it for anything, as long as the demand keeps on going up, the price is going to keep on going up. There's a thing in Bitcoin called hodling, hold on for dear life, right? Where people buy it and just keep it forever. And if they don't use it and they just keep it, the supply gets smaller while the demand keeps on going up because the price is going up. And so, you know, I'm okay with owning Bitcoin. I have some, right? I've had some for a long, long, long time. And I'm happy the price keeps on going up, but you got to realize that because you're not going to use it for other things and it's not really spendable, that price can, as much as it can go up to 100, 200, 250, $1 million per Bitcoin, it could also go down to a dollar. So you talk about risk reward. If you're willing to deal with that, then
it's like owning an NBA team, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Sometimes you think you got a great team and it, nope.
Well, you've had definitely some great teams along the way. You got a really amazing one right now with Luka and all. And speaking of great teams, and every great team is clutch. Every great team, it comes down to the clutch, the 2 minute, last 2 minutes of the fourth quarter, last 2 minutes of the drive, last 2 minutes of the game. You know, you thrive off of that. So Jeff Dye, we gotta throw him through the fire here with Jeff Dye's little 2 minute drill here on Danger Talk. You ready?
I'm ready for it. All right, here's how we do it, Mark. I'm going to fire at you a bunch of questions in 2 minutes. You're going to answer first as quick as you can, and then Russ will answer, and then I'll move on right to the next question. Sound good? All right.
Yep.
You ready, Russ?
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's roll.
All right, 2 minutes on the clock. Let's do this. And, okay, waterfront property or a cabin in the woods?
Waterfront.
Waterfront.
All right, mutual. Greatest Maverick of all time for Mark and greatest Seahawk of all time for Russ, and you guys can't pick yourselves.
Dirk.
That's a good question. I'm Steve Largent.
All right. Favorite movie of all time?
I love stupid movies. American Pie.
Wow.
That was my favorite movie in middle school for a lot of reasons. Anyways, I would say, you know, listen, this is, I'm a romantic by heart. I'm going with Hitch. Will Smith. Will Smith.
Oh, wow. No big Hitch and Mike. From either of you? All right. Pete Carroll or Mike Tomlin? Go for it.
Mike Tomlin.
Pete Carroll.
I know that. I agree with Russ again. Would you rather star in a TV show or a movie? Go ahead. 1 minute.
Movie.
I would rather start in a TV show, I think, because it's get so many episodes. It's,
yeah, get that, you know, episodic, baby. Great. I like your style. Yeah. All right, favorite show you've binged in quarantine, and if you haven't, just your favorite show you've ever binged.
Favorite show in quarantine, Ozark.
Ooh, yeah. Ozark's been good. I definitely binged that one.
30 seconds.
You know what show we're watching right now is This Is Us. We're a little late. But we're me and Sierra are binging that right now.
Nice. Twitter or Instagram?
She picks all your shows. Yeah, my wife. Go ahead.
Twitter,
I'm sorry,
or Instagram? Yeah. Go.
Twitter.
I'm a Twitter guy.
ETF or individual stock?
Individual stocks.
Individual stocks.
All right. Cup, cupcake or cake? 5 seconds.
Cupcake.
I'm going cake, red velvet cake, cheesecake. Let's go.
All right. I think we learned a lot here, guys. That was the 2 minute drill. I go for the hard hitting questions, Mark. That's what I like to know.
Yeah, take it on the big ones, right? Take it on the difficult questions.
I know that'd be the hardest 2 minute drill of your life right there.
My life. The challenges were incredible.
That's what I bring to the show.
Well, listen, speaking about this, you know, Mark, you've given us so much insight on ownership. How you've done it, how do you treat relationships and your team bonding and everything else, and just, you know, your history of how you went from selling garbage bags door to door, knocking in magazines to owning the Mavs and owning so many other things, your entrepreneur, you know, mind and everything else. And one of my favorite things I like to ask at the end is, you know, I own a company called Good Man Brand. It's been a blessing to obviously give back, and to, we give 3% of the of you know, when somebody buys something, we give 3% to the Why Not You Foundation, which is Sierra and I's foundation. And we donate to those young kids and everything else. It's just an amazing process. But one of the things that we have this campaign called the Everyday Hero, and it's been super fun, and just that whole process, and something that we're really passionate about. But what I would love to know is, have you had a hero in your life that, you know, we want to give them something. We want to give them, you know, something nice and everything else. But do you have a hero that somebody who's inspired you, somebody that has really motivated you to give back and to serve, and somebody that's really been a true hero in your life?
My dad.
Your dad?
Yeah. That one's easy. My dad. I mean, he went to work 6 days a week, busting his ass just through the three boys. Could just have a life. You know, never complained, always motivated me, always supported me no matter what, no matter how bad I messed up. It was just, for him, he was never given anything. He had a hard life, you know, when he was a kid. But he always put us in a position, you know, to be loved and to know that he would always support us even when things were going bad. And so he's always been my hero.
Yeah. We'll definitely have to look out. And what's your dad's name?
Norton. Norton.
Yeah. May I ask, is your dad still alive?
No, he died 2 years ago.
Two years ago.
My mom's still around, but we lost my dad 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously Norton, he's, you know, definitely been amazing to obviously raise you and to get you to where you are today. So it's so amazing. We'll definitely have to give some, we'll send some Good Man Brand your way. And
I appreciate that.
What size shoe do you wear?
12.
12. Well, all right. We'll get you some nice 12s and we'll send them some of your way and to your brothers too. I'll text you and get some of that info and get it your way. But man, just, we're grateful for you. This has been amazing to have you on Danger Talk. We've had some amazing guests along the way, and just having you has been amazing. I've always admired you and just your business mindset and all the things that you've done. Your acting is pretty good too. And just, it's been a blast. So I'm still waiting on that 10-day contract though, Mark Cuban. I'm still sitting here waiting. Someday.
You're a good dude, man. It's always been fun. You're so down to earth and fun to talk to, and you know, it's always a pleasure. And when you asked me to come on, it was just like, absolutely. There's just no doubt. You know, and now if I would have known about Jeff, that might have changed things up a little
I'm
bit.
I'm the wild card, baby. I'm the wild card. Russ is a good man. Russ is a great man. He sent me some decent man clothes for Christmas. I'm like, I'm right in the middle, you know, some decent man.
Well, listen.
But I appreciate you, guys, man. I really enjoyed it. It was great questions. It really made me think and it really touched me. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And hopefully you enjoy this free agency here as you're along the way.
I gotta go right now.
All right. Well, that was amazing. Obviously to have, the one and only, you know, Mark Cuban on the line here at Danger Talk. And just, he's been so inspirational, and done so many cool things. And I just think about, you know, all the amazing guests that we've had. You know, all the guests that we've had been pretty spectacular. But what was your favorite part about Mark, you know, Cuban?
I liked that he wasn't afraid to hold back anything. If you seem like with every question that was asked, he was like so open to be like, you want to talk about finance? Sure. You want to talk about business? You want to talk about Shark Tank behind the scenes? Like, that's a man who genuinely just shoots from the cuff. Like, literally every answer was he might be our most honest person I think we've ever. Not that the others weren't, but he's so forward.
Yeah, he was obviously for him to walk us through, you know, everyone that, you know, everything that he's gone through, and just from selling, you know, trash bags on the street to everything else, you know. And so I just really, you know, you think about people like Shaq and some of the people that we've had, you know, on the show and everything else, like what. Those two guys are somewhat similar, even though Shaq was, you know, even though Shaq was a player, you know, very entrepreneurial, a big mindset. You know, you think about, you know, some of the other people we've had too as well. But Mark, obviously, to be a multi-billionaire, to go from nothing to something and all the things he's done. And what I really loved about his story was the fact that, you know, he's sitting there realizing he's going to be a billionaire, sitting in the Dallas Mavs, you know, stadium and like, you know, arena. And it's like, where's the energy at? Like, like just the fact that he wanted to build culture was really cool to me, you know, and just wanting to do that, I thought was really cool too.
Well, I just think about like, even like I was saying, just how forward he was, the fact that you were able to ask him, what's it like being a billionaire? And he was just straight up honest. Like, it feels really good. And I think those, I loved every answer he gave. It was pretty cool. Pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah, you know, I love how you talked about his family too, and just, you know, raising his family and what that looks like. And, you know, it's always inspiring when you get to hear how people have kind of created their opportunities and everything else too as well. So, I mean, the fact that he was in the middle of free agency on this call right now too was pretty fun to see, and just how calm he was and how excited he was to be able to, you know, to deal with that and everything else.
I'm noticing a pattern on all these episodes. Every guest, including you, everybody keeps talking about this whole family thing. I'm thinking about getting one of those families.
Yeah, you gotta figure out how to get a family.
Yeah, how do I get a family? That's what I gotta figure out.
I don't know. I mean, you know, what are you working on right now? You working on anything?
All right, let's talk about Mark Cuban, Russell Wilson.
I think I remember going back to Entourage set and being on the movie set and just me and him engaging. We literally sat there. First of all, movies take forever to shoot. So we're literally sitting there all day for this one scene. And the scene was probably 30 seconds in the movie, you know, but it's amazing how long it takes to shoot all that. But me and him really bonded then. And that's when we, you know, shortly after, I ended up going to Dallas to go, you know, see a game and, you know, sit there with him in the front row and experience that whole game and the energy of the stadium. And so, but I thought Mark Cuban, his business perspective, and I love the fact that we've been able to, on Danger Talk, been able to have so many, you know, different perspectives and worldviews and experiences, but yet success and failures at times, you know, in the midst of it all. And from life to storylines like Mike Tyson's to just things that people have gone through and what Shaq has done, what Candace Parker has gone through, and just Matthew McConaughey and his experiences, to all the way to Mark Cuban and his business experience, but also life experience coming from Pittsburgh. So that was one of my favorite Danger Talk episodes for sure. And
I was hoping he would say Terry Bradshaw. He didn't give me a Terry Bradshaw answer. He gave me the Mean Joe Green, but it's all right.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Well, Jeff Dye, it's always a pleasure, man. And grateful for you. Danger Talk's been amazing. And this has been a fun process. And obviously, Mark Cuban was on the line today. So, yeah, that was great. Well, listen, we got a special guest next week, too. And we just finished with Mark Cuban. And now we got another guest that we can't wait to tell you guys about later. But we're fired up. And just keep tuning in, keep listening, keep telling your friends, keep spreading the word. And we'll see you guys next week. Danger Talk. We out.
We out.